This episode is brought to you by Seminary Now, a streaming video platform that offers masterclass-style courses from more than 60 leading Christian thinkers, including some amazing New Testament, Old Testament scholars, and including my course, Managing Anxiety. You can get unlimited access for just $14 a month when you use the discount code CUSS30 at seminarynow.com/CUSS.
You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cuss.
All right, friends. Hey, this is actually the first episode that we're recording since we hosted the Unlocking Faith Conference. I'm here with Jimmy Carnes. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, tell us about this conference we just hosted. What was it all about?
Oh man, I loved this conference. It was this idea of trying to figure out what gets in the way of us experiencing the goodness of God. It was called Unlocking Faith, and we went into different tools to basically unlock the keys to, you know, how you can experience the goodness of God. And what I thought was super fun is that each one of the speakers, we actually prepared our messages completely separately from each other. But as God does so many times, he really strung it together in a way that I don't think we could have made it more cohesive if we had planned on it.
Yeah, it was kind of freakish that way. Yeah, because we're not prone to wanting to control what people bring. We kind of like just bring what you bring. That's why we wanted you to speak.
Yeah,
and then just watching it all line up in a flow was amazing.
Oh, it was so good.
Yeah, so you spoke, I spoke, Lisa Cuss spoke, Renee Loring, our crew.
Yep.
We also had Chuck DeGroat flew in and spoke.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had Andy and Jill Gullahorn. Just tell us, what was maybe one thing that struck you? Like, there were so many things that happened, but what might have been one thing that struck you, either from people speaking or people's experience in the room?
Yeah. So Lisa shared a little bit about parts of self. And I was talking to somebody who attended the conference afterwards. And they said, man, if somebody came and all they heard was to start paying attention to what your body is telling you, and this idea of disintegration and even knowing that that's a thing, that, man, that can be a game changer for people in ministry who really tend to suppress their own needs and pour themselves out for others and just don't pay attention to their own body and soul. And so he was just like, man, if that's all somebody grabbed from this conference, it's just a massive impact.
Yeah. Yeah, I was struck. Obviously, I get to live with her, so I learn some of that stuff. But she put a diagram up on the screen that was super helpful, mm-hmm. where we had the true self, and then it was surrounded by these parts. And when I used to teach the inner critic, I used to teach us to essentially be harsh to it or fire it or something like that. And I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, Lisa said, well, that's not going to get you very far. Why don't you ask it what it's protecting you from?
Yeah.
Like, okay. Because it's obviously, and that's what she really brought out in the conference, is a part of ourself kind of rises up to guard from vulnerability, mm-hmm. therefore blocking God's goodness, right? That was a lot of what she was reflecting on.
Yeah, I mean, so many things. It's like baby out with the bathwater type stuff, is that we tend to act extremely, and there's often redeemable things in the, it makes me think of, you know, like evil genius is genius first before it's evil, right? I don't remember who said that. Maybe it was Jay Stringer. I want to give credit there, but I don't remember who it was.
Yeah.
But this idea of this inherent goodness that then gets twisted.
Yeah.
And pretty often we look at the twisted part and think the whole thing's garbage.
Yeah. Evil genius will forever make me think of Heinz Doofenshmirtz.
Oh, was that from Phineas and Ferb? Oh, man, I never watched that show.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Just the idea, I just can't get, I mean, the fact that his mother wasn't at his birth, that's a rough trauma story. But also, he had to throw his own surprise birthday when he was 6.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, his backstory was difficult.
That's pretty great.
But, yeah, all he wants to do is spread evil in the tri-state area because he knows he doesn't have what it takes to spread it around the world. I mean, how can not love this guy?
I missed a gem there in that
show. Oh, it's not too late. Yeah, and with your kid's age, yes. I've learned, you know, we have a global audience on the podcast, but I think Phineas and Ferb is largely North American. But if you can find it, listeners, very well worth your while. Hey, talk to me about Andy Gullahorn and Jill Phillips, husband and wife. Mm-hmm. We had them come in just to get into our heart in a different way than speaking.
Yeah. Oh, man, what great thinkers and communicators. I think that inherently built in because they are musicians. They do have kind of the extra edge of taking such great thinking and communication skills, but delivering it in music. It's like a vehicle that can take messages into the parts of us that I think words alone can't always make it on their own. But I think more than that, I think the magic of this particular conference was all the mic conversations between the songs to where they were sharing their own vulnerability. And then, yes, it comes out in their music. I actually don't know how they do what they do. But I think that it's pretty amazing to see that it's real and it's vulnerable and something that could be poetic. And when you write music, you can take liberties, like in books and music, you kind of take things to an ideal or an extreme to make a point. Yeah. But to see the stories behind these songs that they've created and how it's not just some theoretical construct, but it's actual them experiencing life. Ugh, yeah. Goodness gracious.
Yeah. Yeah. So they had no plan. We just gave them basically 25 or 30 minutes in these slots. And they said, if you don't mind, we won't create a set list. We'll listen to the talk and then just get up. And I was like, hey, if that works. And man.
Yeah. My brain doesn't even comprehend that. Yeah. That's amazing.
Let's nerd out on them just a little longer. You and I, both musicians. I just want to talk about Jill's vocal cords and Andy's fingers.
Yeah.
What is it? Like, Jill has this thing. What is that thing?
Man, I know that I've experienced that before and felt great. I don't know if it's shame in my own offerings or whatever, but you hand a guitar, like your guitar, let's say, to somebody else, and they just play it, and it suddenly sounds like another guitar. Yeah. I don't really fully understand that, but Andy definitely has those fingers.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Yeah. So the reason we're talking about the Gullah Horns is they just really were an incredible gift to the conference, and a lot of people don't know them. So we'll put a link to some Spotify in the show notes.
Yeah.
People can check them out. Okay. So one thing that I took from the conference, and I think this will set up our episode today, I think, Jimmy, us in the Capable Life team, we're just learning more and more how hungry people are for safe space to be themselves. And that was, I think, almost more than what struck me from people speaking was the response of the people who are live in the room.
Mm.
We obviously had people joining online as well, but we got so much feedback that people were just starved to come into a space. And I think we have learned intuitively how to create that space, not just with what we say, but even our decor and stuff.
Yeah.
And people could let their guard down for a couple of days and be exactly themselves. So I think that's what I took away, is like, okay, we need to keep finding ways to create that for people in person and online.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of the heart of this podcast. That's what we're hoping to do, is help people feel exactly themselves so they can unlock some things in the podcast as well.
Yeah, I think that this world desperately needs anybody who's willing to go into that space and pull that out of people, or give them an opportunity. I guess a better way to say it is provide a space where they can feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah.
Something does happen when you don't just try and think your way into change, and you actually externalize and experience vulnerability with other humans.
Yeah.
That's where the magic is.
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to take the chance of embarrassing you. You gave us a keynote. You were the last keynote and kind of wrapped it up for us. Mm. And your integration of systems theory and Enneagram was like stunning. It was amazing. You called it a framework.
Yeah.
And you laid out for us this journey from the Garden of Eden into well-being. And it was really amazing. Mm. So I just want to let people know, if you missed the conference, you haven't missed out. You can actually still access it on demand. So it's on the Capable Life website. For members, it isn't included in the access pass. It's an extra thing. So that means whether you're a Capable Life member or not, you can go to capablelife.com and you can buy access to it. So you're speaking, I'm speaking, Lisa, Chuck DeGroat, all of Andy and Jules' music is on there, Renee Loring.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, folks, solo episode, that means the very trusted sound of lighting a candle. Hey, this is actually a Capable Life candle.
Yeah.
Eucalyptus mint. It's the connected, aware, and present candle. We actually design one, and sometimes we give it to clients. So if you want Jimmy or I to come and speak, we might bring you a candle as a gift for bringing us out. This is a 3-wick candle, And we did a 3-wick candle on purpose just to remind us of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. I know I'm prone out of those three to think the least about the Holy Spirit. And so it just helps me as I light a 3-wick candle. It helps me remember, oh man, the Trinity is with me together. And then, Jimmy, I'll never forget when Richard Rohr explained the Trinity was like a water wheel of love, that each member of the Trinity is overflowing with love and simply pouring it into the other, and that's what makes it go around and spin out to us. I thought,
oh, wow.
Yeah, that was all right. That was all right. Thanks, Richard Rohr. Okay, so we are in episode 3 of a 4-episode series. I wonder if you'd just give us a little recap on where we've been, and then we'll launch today's dynamic.
Yeah, we've talked about assumptions and reactivity. So, I mean, just briefly with assumptions, it's these things that we assume about the way that the world works. A lot of times it's things that are sometimes true, but maybe not all the time true.
Yeah.
And so their expectations. One of the ways you can find your assumptions is by looking back at your family of origin and what we call family propaganda, ways that you were raised to believe the world works. I loved your example of memento. It's that even once we name these assumptions, they still show up on a regular basis. We have to wake up and almost have to remind ourselves that the gospel gives better news than these assumptions lead us to believe.
Yeah.
And then reactivity. This is where you go from calm to agitated in an instant, the 0 to 100, when a value is violated. We talked about some ways to recognize reactivity of bigger and smaller. And really that it just acts like acute anxiety. It acts like you've just stumbled upon a snake and you think that you're in trouble, but it's usually something, you know. I think my example was somebody driving in the left-hand lane really slow.
Yeah.
And it's like that based off this idea that, man, you should be more aware of your surroundings, and don't you see that you're causing a problem? Yeah. You know, really something that sets me off.
Yeah. Great. So these are the 4 dynamics that infect every relationship. We've covered 2. So if that whet your appetite and you're a new listener, you can go back to the episodes that Jimmy and I did. We did 1 each on assumptions, 1 on reactivity. The final 2 dynamics are stuck patterns and attempted solutions. Today, Jimmy and I are going to kick around stuck patterns. Mm. So I guess it's a fair question. What's a stuck pattern?
Yeah, I think it's one that is predictable and recurring. I think that we can get stuck pretty often, but humans, I think, by design are great at figuring out problems. But I think that the problem is that if we aren't aware of our proclivities, then we can tend to find ourselves in the same situation over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's when you can almost set your stopwatch by it of once you start observing the way that you show up or others or a group, you can start identifying patterns that don't resolve by themselves. It's almost like they just keep spiraling deeper.
Yeah, and what's weird about a stuck pattern is how easily we fall into it, even if we do have some awareness. It is kind of like an assumption.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you might even notice a stuck pattern, but it's like, oh, well, I fell right into it again. They're like a black hole, or they've got their own gravitational force or something, or they're like a moth to a flame. I don't know what the right metaphor is. I just know that I've never met a stuck pattern I'm not happily running into and getting caught up in.
Makes me think of those things they used to have at the mall where you drop a nickel or a coin in. You know, black hole, I guess, is what made me think of that. But
yeah,
it's one of those inevitable things where you just keep... You know, at first it's slow, but as it gets closer to the center, you go around real fast and drop through the hole.
It makes me think of gambling is probably an interesting, simple, stuck pattern that people can notice.
Oh, yeah.
Like when I was 13, do you remember, this was in Australia, I'm guessing this was in America. In Australia, like local small town fairs would have this machine with a bunch, in our case it was 20-cent pieces or 50-cent pieces, in America it'd be a quarter, lots of them. With a push arm.
Oh, yeah.
And you drop your coin in because it looks like you're about to get a windfall.
Yeah.
So I was 13. This is how I knew, oh, I could be a gambling addict. I think I spent like $11 or $12 of 20-cent pieces.
Mm-hmm.
believing that the next quarter I put in or the next coin I put in would make me a fortune.
Yeah.
That's a stuck pattern.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have a similar gambling story of lost all my money and was there with friends and I found myself borrowing money from two of my friends on either side of the craps table. It was the same craps table. And I was like, hey, can I borrow, you know, whatever the denomination was? And I'd go and play it to pay back my friend on the other side of the table. It was not substantial money, you know, so it didn't ruin my life, but it was enough to give me a taste of, and I just thought, man, if I could just get back on top, then I'd have my own money to play with and lose or win with.
But I guess it's a whole other conversation when there are people or organizations hyper aware of human proclivity towards stuck pattern and exploiting it.
Yeah,
that is what the gaming, well, I used to live in Las Vegas, obviously.
Yeah.
And I was always so mad at meeting in a casino and just seeing the overwhelming sound of money being won, so to speak, and this tiny little plaque in the corner, like this tiny little 4-inch plaque with a phone number. If you have a gaming problem, you know, right. Like, come on.
Yeah.
That whole city is like a predator against human stuck patterns, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess that's the movie and the television show industry of them exploiting, you know, all the stuff that we teach at Capable Life and on this podcast of the relational dynamics, you know, knowing what gets us good drama and kind of just poking it, right? It's the same kind of thing of, you know, you talk about stuck patterns. That's all over the screen.
Yeah, right. Okay, so then the signs of a stuck pattern are they are predictable and recurring. The second sign or maybe thing you can pay attention to is, man, how easily you get caught up in it without noticing it. That really is wild because you can sit here today and say, oh, here's a stuck pattern in my life, and then just fall right into it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the third thing, which will be our next episode, we'll really be diving into this, a sign that you're stuck is your attempted solutions are what keep it going or make it worse.
Yeah.
So we don't want to spoil next week, but I'll just say one of the things you're looking for, we'll give you a little preview, is when you're trying more of the same or try harder, and it's not changing the pattern.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between a problem and a stuck problem?
Yeah, I think that like we opened and when we talked about what makes a problem stuck, I think that there's a tool that we use to try and get out of stuck patterns. And we've tried to use it before when we realized that, oh, you're not actually stuck. I think it was the children's department that was trying to solve a problem. And you share the story often, I'm going to get it wrong, but it was this idea that, no, that's a problem, but you've got the tools to solve it.
Yeah.
Whereas we're looking for almost like, who is it that said that what got us here isn't going to get us out of here? Maybe it's Einstein, the thinking that got us
into
this.
I think it is Einstein, yeah.
Yeah, that's going to show my ignorance there. But basically that you're stuck because you are more of the same and try harder. And the very things you're trying to do to get unstuck are making it worse.
Yeah.
And so that's when we find it so valuable with the tools we use, whether it's a verbatim or a genogram. One of the biggest benefits of those tools is people are outside the system, right? That you bring in somebody that isn't caught up in your emotional reactivity or whatever the thing that's keeping you stuck. And it's an actual, like a lifeline that's from outside of the black hole that can pull you out.
Yeah, yeah. This is more advanced work, but a lot of the work we do with people is what's called imaginative gridlock. Mm. Ed Friedman obviously talks a lot about it. And it is that you're just, your head is down. You can't see the whole picture. Anxiety's gotten you into a black and white thinking, rigid thinking. Probably the simplest example I can think of in my life is, this is fairly recent. Like, it's always interesting to me as somebody who teaches these tools that we're not immune to them. We get into stuck patterns because we're all stuck in our own systems.
Mm-hmm.
So it was me and two staff members at Discovery trying to figure out how to turn the kitchen into a cafe. The kitchen was on one side of our lobby. The nursery was on the other side of our lobby. And we spent hours and hours walking the kitchen. How do we expand it? We had duct tape on the floor trying to map out a new thing. And we had a new staff member come in who is quite famously a free thinker, Tom.
Yeah.
And within minutes, he can see the three of us. I mean, we have genuinely put, I bet, several dozen hours between us into trying to solve this problem. I don't know that Tom was with us 5 minutes when he said, why don't we just flip, why don't we turn the kitchen into the nursery? The nursery will become a perfect cafe.
Yeah.
And in some ways we were stuck because we were locked into plumbing. Well, the kitchen has plumbing, but of course the nursery had plumbing because it's babies.
Yeah.
It's required. Also, if I may, the nursery had a beautiful exit onto a porch, perfect for a cafe.
Right, yeah.
That'd be an example of a stuck pattern. You get someone outside your system. So we're going to look at stuck patterns in three ways. Stuck patterns in yourself, like internal ones. Then we're going to talk about, okay, what about stuck patterns between two people? And then stuck patterns in a group. So I've got a story for stuck patterns in yourself. I'm thinking of someone that went through our class and her husband was a youth minister in a local church. And he kind of enjoyed making statements that might provoke parents. Mm. And she was a people pleaser. So there she is at the for a parent night. This youth minister's up front addressing parents. She's in the back of the room and she's feeling all of the reactions of the parents as her husband intentionally stirs them up or provokes them.
Mm.
And then her plan was to anxiously go around and kind of smooth over everything, which would then kind of unwind some of her husband's intentional provoking, which would then get them into trouble with each other. And she described it. I remember her going through our class and she's like, it's just like I'm a moth and they're a blue light and I just fly into it every time.
Yeah.
That'd be an example of a stuck pattern in yourself.
Yeah. I mean, one that just came up today, right before we started the podcast, I was sharing with you how I don't know when I'll learn that I'm a deliberative thinker. Right. And I want so badly to be a rapid thinker because I see people who think rapidly and I think, oh man, either that means they're smart or whatever it is. It's pretty simple and pretty short, but I caught myself again going, man, when will I give myself the second or two or minute or two to think of the answer and not beat myself up for it?
Yeah.
Right. That's another stuck pattern. I do it all the time, you know, of like, man, there I go again.
That's a great one. Cause your kind of there I go again becomes the, we'll get to this next episode, but that does become the attempted solution, which then just keeps you in the stuck pattern.
Yeah.
Because I actually watched you in real time. You were trying to think of a movie reference that we may chat about
later
in the episode. And you got it. And
it
only took, I didn't even time it, but it wouldn't have been 30 seconds.
Yeah.
But to you, it probably felt like 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah. I felt completely stuck. Like, I won't get it. And what will that mean about, oh, there's more evidence that my brain doesn't work and all those messages. And I think that, I don't know if you had planned to talk about it, but I really think it's important to name one of the reasons why we get stuck and maybe stay stuck in a recurring pattern is our willingness to carry that load, right? Like I think we talked about it at the conference. You asked, this stuff can be hard. I think you said, you know, when we do this work, the work can be hard, but what we're already doing is hard, but we just don't notice it. And I think that that's a piece of, if you think of a recurring stuck pattern, like the moth to flame example, it's our willingness to continue to go and be burned.
Yeah.
And I find that a lot of times freedom comes once we're finally fed up with doing it. It's like, okay, I'm done.
How much longer am I going to keep running into this brick wall?
Yeah. And to invite somebody into the work before they hit the wall really changes the resources that they have at their disposal when they go and do the work. Like if you wait until you're burnt out or your back's against the wall to do something about it, you just have less resources at your disposal to do the work and make a change.
That's good. Well, and it does bring us back to assumptions, because a lot of the work we do in helping people dislodge stuck patterns is focus on their assumptions about the future.
Yeah.
So like this youth minister's wife assumed, if I don't anxiously go around and smooth things over, the future is bad.
Yeah.
Which wasn't true.
Right.
But that was what kept her in the stuck pattern. So some of the most powerful work you can do, because anxiety does, it calcifies your brain. It stops you from imagination. You're just so convinced that you must stay on this treadmill, otherwise bad things will happen.
Yeah.
One of the things I've enjoyed doing lately, it might be cruel. I hope it's not cruel. When I do workshops, I'll often in public prescribe for a perfectionist to send an email with six mistakes in it, right?
Yeah.
And then I can see the perfectionists in the room, and several of them squirm like they're in pain.
Yeah.
And that's because their anxiety is telling them the future will be a disaster if you do that.
Yeah. Or they're asking why? Why would I do that? Right?
Yeah. Like there is the other category of some people are now, they're not squirming. They're now looking at me as a person not to be trusted.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But either way, that's because their anxiety is telling them an assumption about the future. Therefore, your only viable option is to keep chasing perfectionism, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It can be a deep rabbit trail. I mean, I've had many conversations about that exact thing of this whole brave practice that involves intentionally doing something that you know you're worried about the Armageddon scenario that's coming. And yeah. Especially ones on the Enneagram, the perfectionists, have a few on my team, and we've had many conversations of like, what if I can keep this bad thing from happening, why wouldn't I?
You're right. Like, that's right.
What, this is some sadistic experiment that's not bringing any freedom, is that what they think, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, so a stuck pattern when I was a chaplain, I was 24 or 25, and I spent 6 months on the OBGYN. They assigned different wards. So I did 6 months of cancer and different things, but 6 months I was in the birthing. And what was amazing about it, Jimmy, was I got to be in the NICU, the NEO, the pre. That was incredible.
Yeah.
But man, I was so uncomfortable in OBGYN. And understandably, it's kind of a woman's world. It's quite vulnerable for those women. And as a young chaplain, I just didn't know, what am I supposed to do? Am I in the room for birth? And I figured out very quickly, no, you're not looking for the chaplain to be in the room for you. So, but
it's astute observation.
Yeah, young and stupid. My attempted solution was to avoid the floor. That was the stuck pattern I got in.
Yeah.
To where the supervisor got a phone call, and the head nurse, I don't think I've ever shared this story before, the head nurse was saying to the supervisor, I think the chaplain doesn't like us because he never comes around. Because for those who don't know, chaplains aren't always just at the worst moments of people's life. You're also kind of treating the staff like a congregation, and you're doing old school pastoral visits. You just pop around every day and see how doctors and nurses and so on are doing. And so that was my attempted solution, that the supervisor had to talk to me and say, you don't like them? And I'm like, of course I like them.
Yeah.
But I was terrified. I just was uncomfortable. And so often this happens, is you have this internal stuck pattern that others make meaning of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually based around likability.
Yeah.
When it's really, you're just managing your own insecurity or something.
Well, and it turns into a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Yeah. It starts with an assumption or, you know, an expectation or something like that. And then it does turn into something that has legs, right? Because you show up a certain way and then people respond to the way that you're showing up.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's a stuck pattern in you. What you're looking for is where you keep running into yourself again and again. And then we'll get to it next episode. But like Jimmy modeled for us, just this idea that he wants his brain to go faster. And instead of relaxing into the pace of his brain, his attempted solution is, oh, you should know better by now. But when you were able to just get off that treadmill, then your brain caught up and here we are. And we may or may not share the movie. We'll tease our listeners. No, I think we'll probably be talking about it. Okay, so stuck patterns in yourself. The next one is, okay, stuck patterns between any two people. The most obvious would be a marriage, but you could also look at a relationship with a parent, a friend. I work with a lot of people that have found that because of their need to be needed, they're always reaching out to their friends and their friends don't often reach out to them.
Mm.
There's a stuck pattern.
Yeah.
What would come to your mind if we're talking about between any two people?
Trying to wait on my deliberative brain, brave practice. Where my brain immediately went is when you said that, I think, oh man, that's why I love the Enneagram.
Yeah.
It's a great window into helping us uncover some of these patterns and not to put two people in two boxes and saying that this number and this number are going to find themselves in these patterns. But that being said, it also is sometimes true, and you can start noticing these things that we want and that we try and take on God-sized jobs to get when you say they need to be needed is what made me think that way.
Yeah. What's interesting about the need to be needed is how much your brain blames your friends. Like, why aren't they caring about
me? Yeah.
Instead of realizing, oh, they've given up trying to care about me because I'm projecting. And I mean, I guess I'm confessing here. I've lived this life. I'm projecting a message that I care for you. I don't need you to care for me.
Yeah.
So I remember a friend of mine called me on the carpet several years ago. We were early in our friendship. And he said, look, you call me and ask how I'm doing and I tell you and you're incredibly kind and encouraging. I try to care for you and you won't let me. That's not a friendship. Yeah. It was a real fork in the road for me. But before he did that, my natural tendency was to blame people from when I felt isolated.
Yeah.
And this really gets to the heart of the power of stuck patterns between two people is the power of going from blaming them to seeing your own complicity. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the other thing it makes me think of is, so for me, I'm not in that triad, so it's not as much about being needed, but for me, it's autonomy and control. And so the way that works for me is that I want things to be, whatever my assumptions are, I think I shared that everybody should be aware of their surroundings. Like, let's say it's consideration, the value.
Yeah.
But really what's happening is that I'm being crushed by the weight of I must be this way to feel worthy or okay or whatever. And when I see other people not doing that, I just go, man, how do you get away with not being crushed by this weight? It's the same kind of idea, just in a different topic, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, back to, I think I finally thought of a stuck pattern in two people. I think my brain was stuck because it happens usually in a group for me, but I used to be the director of worship arts at Discovery. And a recurring stuck pattern that happened with multiple people. And that's the other way you can learn it is that when you find yourself in the same stuck pattern with multiple
that's
people.
That's really good.
You can start identifying your
own. Multiple individuals.
Yes, yes.
In like independent situations, but you're the common denominator.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah, like, okay.
Shoot.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so one of them was, so we've talked on the show before about both of our attention to timeliness.
Yeah.
And so, you know, inevitably we'd have late musicians, but it's not because something came up there. They're chronically late, right? And to start paying attention to, you know, what I do when they're late, because my internal dialogue is like, wait, do I say something in front of all these other people who are already ready, you know? Do I make it a bigger deal than it is? Do I talk to them afterwards and make it maybe a bigger deal than it is? Or do I just say, it's not a big deal?
Yeah.
And then wonder why it keeps happening when my response is, no problem.
No problem.
No worries.
Yeah.
Take your time. Saunter in.
Yeah. Yeah. We weren't doing anything anyway. Yeah. We had a children's worker that did a verbatim on this, and it was really powerful for her because people would cancel at the last minute on Saturday for serving on Sundays. And we would, and she's like, this keeps happening. And we said, well, what are you doing about it? Oh, I told them it's no problem. And we really drilled down for her because what was going on is she feels so anxious for them that she's smoothing over the impact and therefore sending the unintended message, we don't need you.
Yeah.
And so then they're, of course, saying, well, if I'm not needed, why would I show up?
Right.
And it was profound for her to realize I've been blaming these random individuals when I'm actually the common denominator. This is the power of noticing stuck patterns is when you start to take responsibility for your own thing. I was in a stuck pattern with some, you know, a handful of critics at the church. And I'm not talking about people that have an opinion, whether I agree or disagree. I'm talking about those few people that love to kick the leader. They just get their kicks out of kicking a leader. That's the way I say it. Well, the stuck pattern with individuals was me needing to explain myself. Which only gave them a bigger boot to kick me with, you know? And I would always go away blaming them. Why can't they be better followers of Jesus? And realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm actually part of the problem here.
Yeah. Yeah, when you were sharing the children's worker story, it made me think about how worthwhile it is to take a look at each one of these cases with enough focus, right? Of like actually, whether it's writing it down or doing a process in a group, to sift through the potentially multiple reasons why you show up the way that you do, right? Yeah. Like it could be, you said smoothing over. I was thinking about kind of the self-fulfilling prophecy of not having enough volunteers.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, man, if I can't afford to lose another one just because I'm holding them accountable or whatever, because I know that one of the things we made a mistake in early on in the AEV booth was trying to make tech jobs dead simple because we thought it was intimidating to do tech. And it's like, man, you could do this job in your sleep, kind of a pitch, you know? And then it was so, it required so little from the human that they're like, why am I here? Yeah. Right. It was one of the tech changes we had was going, no, this is important. And here's what you need you to do and all that kind of stuff. And found that the problem was our pitch, you know, yeah, and what we were treating it as. So
that's a really good example, because I watched that happen in real time, where you went from anyone can do it to not the Marines, we need a few good men, but I watched you. What you did is you made sure that anyone who showed up had so much to do that if they weren't able to do it, the service would be affected.
Yeah.
And you didn't invent work. It wasn't busy work. You just kept stacking the needs of the day onto people until it became, oh, we really need you. That was quite a genius move. It's a great example of noticing a stuck pattern, noticing your proclivity, and then working, dissolving it, really. Hey, listeners. Hey, I went to seminary in the 1990s, and I would describe it as transformative to my faith. Our professors exposed us to scholars who helped us understand the cultural context of the Bible. They also helped us approach our faith in a holistic and integrated way. They, I'd say, significantly expanded my Christian worldview way beyond my own culture. What's amazing to me is how many of these authors, the people that were on the spines of my books, are now accessible to all of us. Seminary Now is a streaming video platform where you can learn from some of the finest Christian thinkers of our time. They've got some incredible Bible scholars, but I also really appreciate how they host so many voices and thinkers from non-majority culture. So you can learn from them theology, Old Testament, New Testament, but also justice, reconciliation, church issues, the contemplative life, and perspectives that are not yours. You'll even find my video course on managing anxiety on Seminary Now. They release new courses every month, and for just $20 a month, you get access to all of it. But I've been given a special offer that I can pass on to you. Managing Anxiety podcast listeners get 30% off. You just go to seminarynow.com/cuss and you use cuss30 at the checkout. Let's get back to a couple of simple stuck patterns just between any two people. So, Jimmy, in a marriage, most married couples, I guess it's, we should first say, we don't sit around looking for problems. So there are also predictable recurring patterns that are wonderful.
Yeah.
Like my wife and I tell each other we love each other multiple times a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's a stuck, well, not a stuck, but that's a recurring predictable pattern.
Yeah.
So some patterns are wonderful, mm-hmm, and they build intimacy and health, and then, of course, some are toxic. But when it comes to fights, and not all fights are toxic, sometimes fighting in marriage is really healthy,
mm-hmm,
but what we notice is it does tend to be predictable and recurring. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I know that in my marriage, even before I knew the tool of the Enneagram, I was very aware of a dynamic of I want to sort through things. You know, when I fight, it's because I care about something, right? And so if I don't care about it, then I don't bother trying to prove it or fix it. And so early in our marriage, this dynamic of I wanted to like, let's all stay in the room until we've sorted this out. Whereas my wife needs time, especially time away from the argument or for me to figure out even how she feels. And so giving her an hour or longer, then we could actually have a productive conversation about how to move forward. But man, I mean, in so many, I mean, we were young in early marriage. Right. I mean, I'm sure this is a common story, but you know, we didn't learn about that dynamic until we had done it, you know, for years, hundreds of times of like, I just thought, man, I don't want us to leave until we've sorted this out. And the thing that would sort it out would to give her time to think about her response.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. Another simple example is if you've ever tried to get a child out the door to school in the morning, almost always a stuck pattern. I like this example because it's the perfect example of stopping assigning blame and taking responsibility for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So for Lisa and I, all three of our kids at different points of their life have struggled with it, although I probably should name for the record, Andrew generally did well. I feel compelled all of a sudden, but our kids have struggled at various times with it. And some of the assumptions, if we're looking at, okay, what's my complicity and what assumptions, is our reputation as parents.
Mm-hmm.
Their timeliness at school somehow reflects on what the school administrators think of us as parents. All know, all know. And therefore, we must anxiously get them out the door.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had various times where sometimes we'll get into how do you dissolve a stuck pattern, but sometimes where we talk to the kids about it, and sometimes where we intentionally work on being very relaxed that morning and just watch them saunter out late and let them and the administrator sort it out.
Yeah.
But that's the beauty of it is you can notice the pattern. We don't need to spend as much time in the third category because it's the same ideas just with more people, and that's stuck patterns in a group. And again, Jimmy, I think this is where sometimes it's fine and sometimes it's not. Let's talk about the dynamics of a staff meeting. What stuck patterns do you see? And we can kind of flesh out, well, when does this matter and when does it not matter?
Yeah. I mean, I think that this came up a little bit with the bigger and smaller conversation of the previous episode, but it is the roles that we tend to play. And I think that we want to be careful and name that when we talk about these things specifically, like let's say that you tend to get bigger when you're anxious, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
What I think is problematic is when that's our primary tool or only tool, or it's happening and we don't realize it.
It's like an autopilot.
Yeah. And so the same thing with group dynamics is that we tend to all play different roles. If you study systems theory, there's even the sibling position, you know, that we can fall into. And so paying attention to those can help us understand, you know, when things get tense or anxious or we find ourselves stuck. It's almost like an avenue to start exploring how to get unstuck. Of like, hey, I wonder if we could shift things up a little bit and it kind of break loose this rut that we're in.
Yeah. Yeah. So in a staff meeting, we a simple stuck pattern would be someone who is always using the most words.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else never speaks up unless they're called upon.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as a leader, what we're encouraging you to do is just notice it,
because
you probably already know it. And a lot of our work is just bringing the subconscious to the surface.
Yeah.
And now you can decide, is this a problem or is it a stuck problem?
Right.
Or is it not a problem at all?
Yeah.
But in my experience, where it becomes a problem is people who are no longer speaking up because they no longer feel safe, or maybe they don't have the emotional maturity to tell you to your face, so they talk about you behind your back.
Yeah.
Now I think you've got a stuck problem. You've got a gossip culture. But the other thing I've noticed is I've done a lot of work as somebody who's verbal, uses a lot of words and dominant. I went through a period of shame on that. And then I realized, wait a minute, those people that never speak up are very judgmental of me. And I learned how to call that out in them. Like, 'cause that's a stuck pattern. Oh, you just sit back and watch me run my mouth and think you're better than me.
Yeah.
But let's talk about how you're robbing us of your view. Or I remember talking to one staff member very specifically, you are robbing us. If you don't speak up, I will get us into trouble.
Yeah.
Like, we need you to rein me in. And if you are sitting back there judging me, that's not helping the body of Christ. That was quite alarming for her to realize that I was onto her, kind of thing.
Yeah. And that's why I love the body of Christ analogy, is that it's not, the goal isn't to make that quiet person into somebody that predominantly uses words, but it is more of finding the balance in the middle and making sure that we're all working together with Christ as the head of the body. I think that that's where we get off, is that we tend to take our particular body part, if we're contending that analogy awkwardly, and just, you know, saying, well, if I'm a hand, then I'm only going to use that skill, you know, versus leaning into the other parts of the body.
Yeah. So let's say you're a leader that tends to be verbose and dominant. That's fine. It's probably, as a general rule, really helped your organization. But what we're encouraging you to do is to explore with curiosity the negative impact of it and to take responsibility for yourself, especially some of the work we do. Leaders don't even know that they're anxious about quiet space. Mm-hmm. So they fill it with words. If they're a rapid thinker, the deliberators are just trying to catch up, or maybe have shut down. They've given up.
Yeah.
And so a rapid verbal processor, if you're the key leader, you may need to break the stuck pattern by using curious questions and a lot of time to dissolve it.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing worth noting too is that when you do start noticing your proclivities or the way that you show up, and then you choose deliberately to take a different stance, to recognize that the system you're in, or the room you're in, or the group of people are used to you showing up a certain way, and to not immediately believe that everybody's going to then be okay with this new version of you.
It's really helpful.
And letting that have enough time for, because the system will create homeostasis. It'll balance out over time, and then you can expect sabotage and all these things. That's maybe for another episode. But as we're looking at, oh man, well, if I don't fill the silence with my words, everybody will be uncomfortable, as the maybe Armageddon scenario or whatever. Yeah. The worst part about it is that actually could be true, especially once you try and do it, because everybody's so used to you being you, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's a really, I think that's a really helpful point, because we will next year be talking about resistance and homeostasis and all of that. But but that brings up, like, all of the work we do, a lot of times people are asking us questions about a one point in time situation.
Yeah.
But all of our work is actually a general cultural health. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, the first time you try this, you should expect it to go really badly. We're interested in what happens after that as you continue down this path.
Yeah.
But it brings a – let's kind of – this is where we wanted to land the episode. How do you break a stuck pattern? And there's no simple answer to this, Jimmy, but when do you name the dynamic? If you're in a stuck pattern with other people, do you know when to name it and when just to work on it privately? That's not an easy question to answer, but it's helpful.
Yeah, I don't think it's easy or simplistic. Other than the simplest it can be, is that if both people want to be well and they want the relationship to be well, then I think it's usually that would be my criteria for saying, okay, let's start with naming the pattern. Mm-hmm. Like, do I believe that both of us want this to be better? And if that's true, it's not all the criteria, because do they have the skills to make it better? Like, there's a lot of other things, but I would always generally start with naming the dynamic if I believe that the other person, you know, wanted things to be better.
Yeah. And really the most disarming way to name the dynamic, because just naming it will probably add anxiety.
Yeah.
So the most disarming thing is to immediately confess your complicity in that dynamic, mm-hmm. which I found to be very disarming of their anxiety. And then I'm generally not trying to tell them their side of the, I'm trying to ask them what they see is their side of it. And almost all the time people know, they just haven't had a chance to talk about it.
Yeah.
It feels like in some ways most of our work is just naming what people have felt for years but didn't know how to name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's, you said earlier, how do we know it's stuck? I mean, the for the perfectionists and the fixers, they could use tools like this and try and make everything better. Yeah. And then they could become problematic of starting to name dynamics everywhere. Like, I mean, that was me in college before I knew all this about myself, is that I could name, I was always a maybe a systems thinker before I knew about systems theory.
Yeah.
If I cared way more about the recurring predictable things than the specifics. And so I was always noticing, hey, did you know that every time you know, and it was all very you focused as
yes,
the other
immature right.
side.
Very helpful.
Of it, right? It wasn't like you just model of like, hey, I noticed that when we get it together, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite annoying, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really trying to figure out, okay, these stuck patterns that cause disconnection, I think those are the ones that are worth tackling.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Okay. And then so naming the dynamic, that's like the middle work. The simplest work or the easiest place to begin is just noticing them. Mm-hmm. And so this does bring up your movie.
Oh.
What's the movie and what did you notice?
If I can still remember. Yeah, we watched Jumanji 2. And when we were talking about, you know, recurring stuck patterns and trying to think where we could see it on the screen, I thought about Dr. Bravestone's, or is he a doctor? Anyway, Bravestone's character is played this round by some old man. He's kind of curmudgeon-y, and he's kind of drunk with power now that he has, the Rock's physique and skills. And as they're trying to, you know, solve the problem of the movie, he inevitably is going to, you know, get carried away and cause more problems. Mm. Until finally, the way they solve it is they just switch characters. Like somebody else becomes Dr. Bravestone because he just can't manage it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was something that popped in my mind of like, man, they just can't help themselves. You just see it coming in the movie of, oh, he's going to make it worse.
Nice. So noticing a stuck pattern, the safest place to notice it is always on the screen because you're not in the system. It's entertaining.
Yeah.
So Jumanji 2, everyone, you can go check it out. But then you do the brave work, you notice the patterns in yourself, you start to notice how you are inexplicably linked to everyone around you, and you're looking for the healthy patterns and the unhealthy patterns. If you are prone to the way you and I are prone, Jimmy, you can easily get overwhelmed by all of them.
Yep.
And so you just pick one, and you'd be very kind to yourself, right? So that's noticing. If you want to do the next step, then you name the dynamic. You sit down with the other person or the group. And, we've done this in our staff. It's like, hey, who tends to speak a lot, who doesn't? And if you can invite people into it, it's uncomfortable and then it's amazing. And then you can all kind of help each other. What I've noticed now that I do more consulting work is I've gone into organizations assuming that they know how to hold vulnerability the way we do.
Mm.
That's not always been true.
Yeah.
And so there are some cultures where they wield vulnerability against each other with sarcasm. They mean well. I don't think it's always abusive. It's just they don't know how to be safe.
Yeah.
And so that's required. You have to, if someone's going to be vulnerable, you can't tease them. You can't be like, well, there you go, running your mouth again. Like that's going to shut them down, make them smaller.
Yeah.
The final, the more advanced work is you reverse the pattern. What have you done there where you notice a pattern in yourself or between you and others and then you're actively trying to flip the script or make it different?
Hmm. Yeah, one that I just thought of that I haven't done practice yet but I'd like to is this whole idea of if it takes me a few seconds to think of the answer, then almost deliberately not answering longer than I would be comfortable.
You know,
I think that'd be a great brave practice of how long can I test the Armageddon scenario. If I just sit quietly until I think of the answer, will people think that I just am out to lunch, you know, that my brain's not working, that it's misfiring, you know, and start to test those assumptions? Because I think that would help relax me into believing that I need to be this, you know, rapid, super sharp, witty person when that's just not the way that my brain works. That's
really good. Yeah. I think of the stuck pattern of my sermon performance and my Sunday afternoon elation or depression based on my completely subjective opinion of the sermon, which even with the conference we did, I'd not done those talks before. It's new material. And in the moment, my first talk felt amazing because I always get drunk on the adrenaline of speaking and I lose objectivity. Mm-hmm. And I went back and watched it. And I'm not mortified by it, but I am like, oh, wow, I've got a lot of work to do to improve. That was very clearly a first talk. It was kind of that.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating So that was an assumption, and I noticed that, the difference between how it felt in the moment and then objectively listening later. And so then what I did to reverse the pattern with my speaking is I noticed that my target was vague and in the moment of speaking, and I moved the target to my midweek preparation, which is specific. I have a system of sermon preparation. I have a amount of time I give to it, which for me is a range. It's 8 to 15 hours. It's quite a range.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, the sermon is a win if I've done my process and put in my time. And that's how I broke that stuck pattern. So that would be a maybe more sophisticated example.
At least very practical. I mean, that it gives you something that you can, you know, measure and notice.
I can hit that target. Oh, yeah. I did the work.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to relax into God's presence and not trust how infected I am afterwards. And Jimmy, it still happens. Like even I just got back from speaking last night. Every time I'm done speaking, my temptation is to repent of it.
Mm.
And so just learning to let it go has been much more freeing. So
yeah,
it's an ongoing thing for sure.
Yeah. And I think that what's rumbling around in my head in this conversation is, you know, whether it's the people that are uncomfortable with the intentional brave practice to do the opposite, or this feels in the same vein of like, oh, well, if I let it go, then this thing that drives me towards whatever it is that's driving you with, you know, whether it's people pleasing or whatever, or it's faith that there is a middle ground between, like, when we take on these God-sized jobs and the must-have to be okay.
Yeah.
And when we relax our grip, it's not like the beginning of this slippery slope to where, you know, you're just suddenly going to stop preparing for all your messages and you're just going to wing it and they're going to be sloppy.
I'm going to be lazy and sloppy.
No, you still have the same values of what you want it to be, but recognizing that we can pursue those, you know, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. We love that, but then we forget about God's peace both in us and afterwards and before us.
Yeah.
It's like this envelope that we're in with God that by relaxing into the goodness of God, it doesn't mean that we don't still have a role to play. And that's a really difficult place to be because we think in extremes and we're worried that if we let off the gas even for a minute, then man, if Armageddon doesn't come tomorrow, it'll come in a month from now.
We'll get caught off guard.
Yeah.
I love that you brought that up because it does make me think about my I'm very passionate about the craft of public speaking.
Yeah.
I read about it. I watch videos. I practice. I analyze. But what it used to be was this extreme shame or elation and this unmanageable need to be approved.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm free to critique myself without shame. Like I'm going back and watching my Unlocking Faith first talk.
Yeah.
And I'm excited. Like, oh, I know how to improve this.
Yeah.
I gave too many concepts. It was too overwhelming. And Lisa and I had a conversation, to be frank to our audience, Lisa and I had a conversation about it because I said, oh, I went back and watched it. It wasn't as good as it felt in the moment. And she said to me, she's like, well, you were doing two things when we the rest of us were doing one thing.
Right.
You were setting up the entire conference and also giving a keynote.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's going to have some different things.
Right.
Whereas my speaking, I'm very serious about one linear journey, but I actually had us on two journeys in that talk.
Yeah.
That was helpful for me. But the point that you're making is the counterintuitive, this move makes it, I'm not going to say it very well, but it somehow frees me to be hard on myself. I'm not being hard on myself, but I'm free to critique it without that anxious extra thing. The way you're chasing with your deliberative brain.
Yeah.
You can kind of relax into it without the anxious, oh no, oh no. Yeah, that's been profound.
It's like this weird magic where it actually becomes better. Like you're afraid that it's going to get worse or sloppy, but when we do it, it's like my saw analogy, right? It's like if you press too hard and you do it yourself, then the teeth get stuck. But it's almost like if you can let the saw do its work, which in this analogy is relaxing into the presence and goodness of God, that you don't stop sawing, right? It actually makes it better.
Yeah. Okay, so next episode, Jimmy and I are on together. We will tackle one of our favorites, attempted solutions.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see you guys then.
All right.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.